And we are rolling. Hi, this is Mark Goldberg with UN Dispatch, speaking with
Alexis Okewo. I'm a freelance journalist based in Lagos, Nigeria, and I've been covering Nigeria and Boko Haram for about 2 years now.
Great. And I've been reading you in The New Yorker recently. That's been fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I remember your May 7th piece was like the first comprehensive explanation of what's going on in American media, print media, since the kidnapping, which we'll certainly get into. So it's been great. So I would encourage everyone to follow you.
Thanks.
So we are recording this. We're speaking on Tuesday. Yesterday, Boko Haram put out this video purporting to show, a number of the kidnapped schoolgirls. And also, the leader made a demand on the Nigerian government, basically asking for a prisoner swap, saying, we'll deal if you'll deal. I mean, how do you expect the Nigerian government to respond to this, this potential, offer?
Well, what's interesting is that there's a lot of confusion right now. So after the video came out yesterday, immediately we heard from a Nigerian minister who said, the Nigerian government will not negotiate with the terrorists. And then later on, towards the end of the day, we heard from the government that they were open to all options. And now today I was reading that the government is trying to distance themselves from the minister's statements yesterday saying that they wouldn't negotiate. And in fact, is now saying that if Boko Haram is willing to come to the table, send some representatives, then it's willing to see what kind of settlement they can reach. I don't know how likely this is going to happen, that Boko Haram will, send a couple of representatives in suits to the capital to speak with the government, but the government says it's open to it.
Is there any sort of precedent for something like that? I mean, Boko Haram has, kidnapping is like one of the ways that they finance their operations. And so supposedly they have ways of, exchanging prisoners, exchanging hostages. How is there any precedent for this kind of swap or this kind of negotiation, would you say?
Precedent for this kind of request from Boko Haram. They've kidnapped Western hostages in the past and said that foreign governments, you only get your people back if the Nigerian government lets some of our members go. It's never been successful before. And I could potentially see it being successful now if there is an actual kind of dialogue between representatives of Boko Haram that we can actually trust our representatives. Because, right now the Nigerian government has never been under more pressure to get people that Boko Haram has taken back. Even when Western contractors have been arrested, have been kidnapped, there's never been this kind of international rallying, this international cry to get people back. And so I can see why now the government is feeling compelled to say, sure, we'll negotiate.
So let's talk about that international outcry. So the kidnapping happened on August 14th. I cover these issues. I don't like cover Nigeria because I cover Nigeria. I sort of like cover these issues on UN Dispatch. And I was looking back and the first thing I wrote about the kidnapping was on August 16th. So a couple days later, but then it really,
April.
So pardon me, April 16th, 2 days later. But then it really wasn't until May 2nd that the mainstream media started picking up on this story. And largely due to the hashtag. And so I wanted to ask you, where did this hashtag originate? And what effect has it had, on the ground in Nigeria among, the Nigerian political elite, among ordinary people? What's been its effect so far?
Yeah, it started because a former education minister in Nigeria made a speech about how it was important. In her speech, she said that it's important to get our girls back. The Nigerian government needs to get these girls back. And someone from there, I believe it was another Nigerian. I'm not sure what he does. He may be a lawyer. He then tweeted, "Bring our girls back" as a hashtag, and it just caught on because it's obviously really pithy. And people, it just sort of mushroomed. Nigerians were tweeting it, and then soon after, people around the world. And it's one of these instances where it's definitely not just a case of online activism. Because what was so interesting is that after that, there were physical protests in the capital, Abuja, and in Lagos, and in other cities all around the country. And, you know, it was kind of protests that the government actually listened to, which was also really interesting, because there was this weird sort of situation where the First Lady said that she would join the protests, even though she later backed off. And it was very clear that people in government were listening, even though they weren't necessarily acting on it yet, but they were listening and were being forced to respond to it. And so, you know, I'll call up people in the government now and they'll say, you know, yeah, we're happy this Bring Back Our Girl things is going on, but they're not necessarily saying what they're doing about it. In fact, the military the other day released a statement saying, you know, we're happy for the Bring Back Our Girls activism, but, you know, protesters are basically saying the wrong things about the military. They're not realizing that the military is doing all it can, which is, you know, debatable. But, I mean, it's a really interesting and great case of how homegrown activism through social media and physical action is making some difference.
I guess, what was it about sort of the protests that caught the president's attention? I mean, you know, Boko Haram has attacked schools before, right? I mean, was it last month they attacked a prep school and slaughtered, you know, dozens of boys there? What distinguished, like, this particular incident beyond others?
I mean, that's a really good question because, yeah, in February, Boko Haram went into a school and killed 59 boys in the most gruesome way, you know, slashing their throats, shooting them alive. And it's attacked several other schools in recent years as well. And so my theory as to why this case was different is, A, the sheer scale of it. I mean, over 300 girls taken from their school at night. B, I mean, which relates to the first, is that these girls are, you know, they're young and they're extremely, you know, at risk because we know what Boko Haram does to other girls and women that they have taken, which is often pretty gruesome stuff, like forcing them to be sex slaves, impregnating them, raping them. And I think C, I think that people were just starting to feel fed up with the fact that something like this would happen, the government wouldn't acknowledge it, and then it would basically just sort of expect Nigerians to forget about it. And I think there was a mood of, you know, enough is enough. I mean, this is over 300 girls. You're not going to say anything? You're not going to do anything about it?
And the response by Good Luck Jonathan and his wife, Patience Jonathan, have been sort of fascinating to watch, particularly his wife, who, you know, I was not, like, aware of her in any significant way, but she seems to be kind of a unique figure. I guess, who is she, and, like, what is she doing? Like, how has she comported herself during this crisis?
Well, Patience Jonathan is known as a very melodramatic woman. You know, Nigerians joke that this is a woman that basically her husband, the president, can't control. And so when she started saying over a week ago, you know, I want to join your protests, after about 500 women marched to government buildings in Abuja, people were confused because they were saying basically, you know, we're protesting against your husband. We're protesting against the government. What role do you have in this? But she was adamant. She said, you know, I will protest even if Boko Haram shoots me. And so, and then that same weekend, she was on TV. She was crying, you know, begging God to return the girls. All very dramatic. And then, like, a day or so later, she had one of the protest leaders arrested. She claimed that the protest leader had misrepresented herself as one of the mothers of missing children. And then she proceeded, allegedly, to accuse this protest leader and another leader of making up the abduction altogether and of belonging to Boko Haram. And she's also attacked school officials in Chibok, the town where the girls were taken, for, you know, not doing their jobs, for being complicit in this kidnapping, just basically trying to pass the blame now. After before pledging to protest with the mothers. And so she's completely just unstable, it seems, and when it comes to what's going on right now. I mean, she's not reliable. And it's confusing because she seems to be speaking for the president, or at least being allowed to speak for the president. And what she's saying isn't good. I mean, it's very disturbing, actually.
So it also seems, though, that good luck, Jonathan, the president also, you know, has, I guess, like, vacillated in his response. I mean, at times I've seen him quoted where he seems to suggest that the kidnapping is some sort of conspiracy against him. But at other times he seems to, you know, be saying kind of the right things as well. I guess how would you characterize how he's responded to this situation so far?
I mean, his response sadly was not surprising because for many weeks, of course, he did not say anything at all, which is his usual MO when it comes to Boko Haram attacks.
Why is that? Why has that been the usual MO?
Well, you know, it's been, as I see it, in a state where he refuses to acknowledge the seriousness and the scale and the impact of this insurgency. He sees it as a something that's not his problem, that's not the fault of his administration. He sees it as something that belongs to the Northeast and something that, you know, is the responsibility of Northern leaders. And so as long as it doesn't affect him and his domain, you know, he's seen it as something that, you know, he can let keep going on in this isolated region as long as he still has the favor of most of Nigeria. And so, you know, it's interesting now because obviously he can no longer look the other way. He has to sort of come out of the state of denial that he's been in and see that this is a war that needs to be dealt with in a smarter, more efficient way. There's never been any urgency on the part of the administration or on the part of the Nigerian military to find people that Boko Haram has kidnapped, unless it's a high-profile case, or to really, I think, to protect northern civilians who are, you know, bear the brunt of these attacks every single week. And so that, I think, explains why he's never just said anything in the past. Now he is being compelled to say things. Sometimes it is the right thing. And then sometimes I think he's saying things that really reveal what is going on in that mind of his, which is that, you know, he does maybe think that that the attention over this kidnapping is a way to embarrass his administration and to prevent him from being reelected next year.
And actually, let's talk about that, because the elections are happening in 2015, nationwide elections, the first, I think, since, was it like 2011, probably? So, you know, how much of a challenge does this pose to his reelection chances? And I guess who are his, you know, challengers? Who are those contending against him? And have they sort of used this to their sort of electoral advantage?
Not so much yet. So, yes, it is likely he will run again next year. He will be facing a variety of candidates. So Jonathan is a Southern Christian president, and so he will be facing Northern Muslim opponents who haven't really, you know, used this. I wouldn't say too much to their advantage in terms of using it to criticize the president, although there are rumblings here and there. And also he'll face some other opponents. But, I mean, Jonathan is the favorite to win. And so I think the question right now becomes is this general discontent, this general distrust that Nigerians have of their president right now when it comes to Boko Haram, will that lead to something bigger? Will that lead to actual action at the polls where they say enough is enough? You're not leading this war the way we want to, and so we're not going to elect you again. I don't think we're there yet, but I'm curious to see if that happens. It could.
So there's another interesting like election wrinkle that was brought up by a guest I had on my podcast. This guy, this Terim expert named Jacob Zen, made the point that, you know, the quality of the elections next year may be called into question if it's, you know, insecurity is too, if insecurity in northeastern Nigeria prevents a nationwide election, a truly nationwide election from taking place. So the, like, the whole legitimacy of the, you know, enterprise may be called into question. Is that a concern that, that sort of, you know, people are talking about now? Like, can you actually hold elections in an area with this, you know, ongoing insurgency?
I mean, that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem because right now we have three northeastern states under a state of emergency. The president has just asked for that state of emergency to be extended for another 6 months. And I imagine that state of emergency will continue to be extended for, you know, as long as it's needed. And it will be very difficult to hold safe and secure polls in places that are basically war zones. And I think this is something that has been sort of whispered about by northern politicians who are saying, you know, is this Jonathan's plan? Is he trying to maintain instability in the north so that come election time, he can easily win without any dissent from the north? And, you know, conspiracy theories aside, I think it's obviously a real risk because, you know, how are we supposed to hold an election when people are being massacred?
And I think, you know, it's worth pointing out, in case, you know, the audience isn't aware, you know, Nigeria is the largest country in sub-Saharan Africa. I think like one in every six Africans is Nigerian. Regional behemoth, you know, really, really important international player. But also, you know, in 2011, like, those elections were generally legitimate and generally considered, you know, free and fair. So, you know, that was good luck, Jonathan, you know, say what you will about him, was, you know, freely elected. And so, you know, if an election can't take place, it would be considered not only, you know, bad for Nigeria, but sort of bad for the entire region, I think, as well.
Oh, completely, yes. I mean, as you said, Nigeria is a major player on the continent, the biggest economy. And a lot of interesting things going on besides this insurgency, a lot of economic growth and innovation and entrepreneurship. But the problem is that, you know, until this insurgency is dealt with properly, it's going to encroach into all these things. I mean, it's already wreaked havoc on the North's economy, local economies. And, you know, if left unchecked, it will only do worse damage. So it is part and parcel of Nigeria's future and how well it will do.
So speaking about sort of the other interesting things going on, you know, this has totally overshadowed pretty much everything, including the World Economic Forum just took place there. How did that sort of go down? Was there, did the kidnapping totally overshadow the World Economic Forum? Or how did events inside sort of the World Economic Forum reflect what was going on around the world? Were there many protests? Were there, you know, I would imagine it was probably an interesting time.
Yeah, I mean, the kidnapping completely overshadowed it. But it was an interesting sequence of events because there weren't any protests against the forum. I think, you know, Nigerians were sort of feeling like, you know, this is an important event. You know, there are other things going on in Nigeria, and it's fine to have this event. I mean, of course, although many were questioning if this was the right time, because the Nigerian government had deployed about 6,000 security personnel to guard this forum. And some people were wondering, you know, why weren't these soldiers sent to up north to look for the girls? But that aside, I mean, you know, I think it was a constant theme throughout the event. You know, many speakers made mention of bringing back our girls. And, you know, I know a lot of government officials at the event were constantly asked about this. And these officials usually said that, you know, they believe it was important to have this event because of Nigeria's extraordinary economic growth. And that also it was important to keep the search on for these girls. So it was a strange event. You know, it was overshadowed by the kidnappings. And I'm not even sure in the end if it was maybe worth it to have this event at this time. But I think that, you know, it was probably done as and the only way it could be done, which is, you know, as low-key and tasteful as possible. I don't think it was really an ostentatious event, except for the fact that it had, you know, these thousands of security personnel guarding the forum, who may have been better used elsewhere.
So what's driving Nigeria's pretty astounding growth right now?
Well, what's driving it is that it has, primarily it's the oil and gas sector. You know, Nigeria is still one of the biggest oil producers in the world. And it's starting to diversify slowly in other sectors, but, you know, primarily it is oil and gas. In terms of that sector, there is still controversy. You know, there may have been up to $20 billion missing from the oil coffers as of not too long ago. But, you know, nonetheless, Nigeria is having some interesting growth that potentially could translate into something long term over the next several years if it's able to really diversify.
So you mentioned this, the missing oil money, and I'm wondering, is the movement that sort of the bring back the girl protest movement, do you see, I guess, any potential for that to morph into something greater, to something that's, you know, more focused on government accountability, to, you know, ending graft, ending corruption, providing better government services, that sort of thing? Do you see this, like, you know, I guess, you know, right now it's focused on you know, specifically on the situation in Northeast Nigeria, but do you see there a potential for it to morph into a grander social movement?
Yeah, I mean, I did at first, to be honest, but I'm not so sure anymore for a few reasons. One is that the leaders of the protests have said that they don't want this to turn into something bigger, that they just want it to focus on getting the girls, which I can respect, fine. But B, you know, and also the attendance of the protests over the past couple of days has not been as strong as one might have hoped. It's still, you know, a steady presence every day, but it's not the kind of numbers one would kind of need for this wider rally against corruption and against malgovernance. And so I don't think right now, I don't see it turning into a wider protest, but I do think there is potential for that perhaps closer to election time, depending on what happens now. I think that if we're still in this kind of situation where the government is still not performing, then I think things can get more active and against the government and sort of more sustained closer to election time. But for right now, I think the sole focus is on bring back our girls.
So on that, what's happening, I guess, today, this week, or on the ground to, you know, to look for and rescue these girls? You know, has the Nigerian military mobilized? What form is the international assistance taking? Is it being welcomed? I guess, like, what's actually happening?
Yeah, okay, so the U.S. has sent a team of advisors, I believe the U.K. as well. Israel is also sending a team. And the Nigerian military says that it sent two battalions to the northeast. As far as what's actually happening, I spoke to a resident of Chibok maybe last Thursday or so, and he said they had seen a couple of fighter jets and a helicopter sort of scanning the nearby forest. And so that got people excited a little because they thought, hey, maybe things are finally happening. And the ones who have heard about international aid are also feeling hopeful because I think we can all agree at this point that it's necessary. The Nigerian military needs help. But we still don't have concrete news as to where these girls have been sighted, any actions being taken, which is understandable because we don't want to mess up any security operations. At the same time, you know, there's very little intelligence coming from either the administration or the military on any updates they have, whether to the general public or to even parents themselves. Boko Haram, as we talked about, released a video yesterday saying that it had the girls and that it would trade them for their own members. Today, the governor of Borno State, which is the state in which Chibok is located, said that parents had identified at least 35 to 50 of the girls who were in the video. So that is an interesting development. And so at least we know that, you know, there are some of these folks who are still alive, still looking relatively healthy. And, you know, we can go from there.
What, I guess, what's the sort of the conversation happening in, like, elite circles about how best to deal with this issue in general, this insurgency? Is there a sense that, like, you know, we have to crush them, kill the bad guys, and that'll be it? Or is there, you know, any other, I guess, how is the conversation taking place?
I think the dominant strain of thought is, yes, we have to just kill these guys. We have to root them out. That's the only thing, you know, that's what you do with terrorists. That's the only way this is going to end. I find that there's a lot of nuance lacking in this kind of discussion, right? Because it's not acknowledging how this group came about, how it's been able to sustain itself through various basic structural inequalities in this country. You know, the fact that the North is extremely less developed, it has extremely fewer opportunities for education, for access to social services, healthcare, and things like that create an atmosphere of Northerners feeling extremely marginalized. There's little talk of that. What there is talk of is rooting out these terrorists and killing them and, you know, crushing them, which they've been saying for over a year since the state of emergency was enacted last year, and there's not been much progress since then.
So, you know, you describe northern Nigeria and these states as sort of an area of relative deprivation compared to the rest of the country. Does that translate into any sort of popular support for this group?
In a sense, right? Because when Boko Haram's founder first started preaching, he was preaching against things that many Nigerians agreed about, right? The corruption of the government, you know, how things were so extremely unequal compared, you know, with the tiny, tiny corrupt elite and masses of people who just didn't have anything because of this graft. And so this is a message that not only Northerners, but all Nigerians can sympathize with. But if you talk to Northerners today, you would be very hard to find someone who is supportive of what Boko Haram is doing in the name of this message. Killing innocent people, abducting innocent people. You know, I've never talked to a Northerner who has said Boko Haram is doing the right thing. You know, most people are horrified and are afraid of this group. And so it's not like, you know, you go to Northeast Nigeria and people are like, yeah, these are saviors. They're horrified. They're frightened. This is not what they want. This is, when you ask them, Muslim Northern Nigerians, they say, this is not Islam. This is not what we as Muslims espouse. And so, you know, there's this disconnect between, fine, we can understand their discontent with the government, but we can't in any way, you know, empathize with the kind of horror they're wreaking in the country.
So I guess just to wrap up, I mean, how do you see this sort of situation resolving itself, either by rescue or not rescue or fizzling out from international attention? I guess what do you see going forward will happen? Like how do you think sort of will this change Nigeria in any sort of fundamental way? Will this search for girls?
Yeah, I mean, that is the big question, right? You know, I really want to have hope that these girls can be rescued. I think if there was some kind of negotiation, that could happen. I think if that does not happen, I think it will be extremely difficult for these girls to be rescued. And so, in any case, I see this going on for a very long time. And I do see it fizzling out of international attention. But I don't see Nigerians, you know, I don't see it fizzling out of Nigerian attention, which is important because I think that's what would lead to any kind of real change come election time next year and after that. And so I think it's very difficult to know what will happen to these girls, but I do think there hopefully is some kind of mood change in Nigeria, and it will be up to Nigerians to really decide whether they've had enough and are going to do something about it.
All right, well, Alexis, thank you very much. This was really interesting and helpful for putting everything in context. So thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks for talking with me.